Well, open your Bibles with me to Genesis chapter 16. We continue in our exploration of the patriarchs, still in the middle of our understanding of Abram, his call, the promises that God has made to him. His name is not yet changed, so that's why I'm still calling him Abram, and Sarai is not yet Sarah. That will be coming very soon. But as we continue in chapter 16, remembering what we looked at last week, this chapter is very significant, and it has long-term implications for Abram, for Sarai, and for the nation of Israel. And last time we looked at the fact that Abram had been in Canaan. He'd been there for around 10 years now. His wife Sarai, who has heard over and over and over again the promises that God has made to Abram of being blessed, of being the father of a great nation, of the land. All of this has been repeated over and over and over. And yet they're not seeing all of this fulfilled. And so there is not yet an heir who has come from Abram's body. And so Sarai has devised a plan that she is going to give to Abram, her maidservant Hagar, and she is going to become his second wife, and she is going to bear a child for him, and that likely is going to be the heir. And so Abram believes this is a splendid plan, and he goes along, and the question is, what could possibly go wrong? Right? You have the promises of God. You have so much that God has provided and prepared for Abram. And they're impatient, which we could recognize and understand. Probably couldn't fault them for trying to take matters into their own hands. But the reality is that Abram is now having a second wife injected into this relationship. And they've come up with this humanly wise plan, nowhere near what God desired, what God wanted, what God intended. And things derail very, very quickly. Hagar gets pregnant. Immediately there is tension within this triangle. Hagar, who is a servant or a slave, is now pregnant to the man of the house, and she has had her position as a second wife elevated, equal to, and perhaps even greater than, the barren Sarai, who cannot give to Abram a child. And so Sarai encounters this great injustice being done to her. Hagar is looking down upon her because she is pregnant, and Sarai cannot be pregnant. And Sarai goes to Abram and says, I want you to fix this wrong done to me. Okay. Abram basically says, well, she's your servant. Do with her whatever you will. What seems right in your eyes. And this is exactly what Sarai does. What Sarai does, what is right in Sarai's own eyes, is to make Hagar miserable. It is to treat her harshly and make her resent every day of her life, which she succeeds in doing very, very well. She treats Hagar so poorly that Hagar flees from the home and is now, as we pick up the story, on her way back to Egypt because she can no longer live as a part of Abram and Sarai's family. So this brings us to the second half of the chapter. We'll spend the remaining part of our time here in chapter 16 today as we continue building on the outline. Number 13 in our growing outline is God's intervention. So the pregnancy plan, the second wife, the mistreatment by Hagar, all of this stuff coming together now. Hagar has fled from Sarai's home. And this now brings us into God's intervention. We're going to read together 7 through 16 here of Genesis 16 and then have some comments about that. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count. The angel of the Lord said to her, "Further, behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers." Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God who sees," for she said, have I even remained alive here after seeing him?" Therefore, the well was called Be'er Lahai-Roi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of a son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. So God's intervention is in light of the reality that Hagar's life is so miserable that she has now fled from Abram and Sarai. And what we learned in verse 6 is reinforced here. So Shur is a desert area in the Negev in the northwest of the Sinai region, very near to the border of Egypt, and Hagar was going home. Now, years ago, when Abram took his entourage into Egypt to find food to be spared from the severe famine, after all of that went awry, Pharaoh sent Abram and Sarai away, and Hagar was very likely one of the servants that was sent with them. And so Hagar is now going back home. She's going to where she came from. She has nowhere else to go. We cannot imagine what it would be like for a woman in this culture, in this time, to leave the protection of the home she was in and to go through the wilderness back to a country whose Pharaoh was willing to give her away as a consolation prize, if you will, to this person who has brought harm into his country. She had no rights, she had no protection, she had no place to go. She's pregnant, she's alone, she is distraught, and she pursues the only option in her mind, and that is going home. It would almost be like taking your 5-year-old and him saying, "I want out, I'm leaving," and you say, "Okay," and you live in the middle of the country. He's got nowhere to go. He's got no way to get there. You have no idea what's going to befall your child. And this is, in a sense, what is happening to Hagar. Alone, without any options, she's just doing what she thinks is the only thing she can do. And she goes home thinking that she is alone. Well, as we continue, let her be. In the midst of this despair, an angel appears. Verse 7. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. So this is the first reference in all of the Bible to the angel of the Lord. And in the Hebrew, it is Malak Yahweh. Malak means messenger. So this is a messenger of Yahweh. Now it isn't quite that simple. This name, this phrase, Malak Yahweh, occurs 48 times in the Old Testament. It occurs 6 times in the book of Genesis, 4 times here in chapter 16, and then it'll appear in chapter 22, 2 times related to the sacrifice of Isaac. So in some texts, the angel seems to be the same as God. And in other, there appears to be a distinction between the angel and the divine God. So in some appearances, there's the sense that it is a theophany, a manifestation of God. In others, there is a sense that this is God's representative, an angel who is going to speak on God's authority as God has given instruction to do so. So in either case, the appearance is either God in a disguised human form, or it is an angel of the Lord who is speaking upon the authority for God and speaks for him. So this particular appearance has the sense that God is here and is disguised in a human form. Now there's a difference of opinion by commentators and authors. Some believe that it is an angel. Others believe that it is a theophany. All we can say for certain is God is speaking authoritatively to the issue that has plagued Hagar as she is fleeing from Sarai. He has intervened in her life. He appears to her in this way, and he poses this question to her, letter C. The beginning part of verse 8, he said, "Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from, and where are you going?" Well, it should be very obvious that the angel is speaking with authority and possesses full knowledge. He knows her name. He knows where she has come from in terms of the home. She is a maid to Sarai. But he asks the seemingly unnecessary question, where have you come from and where are you going? So he knows her name, knows the name of the one that she serves, and this emphasizes, and this is lost on us in the English, but this emphasizes her lowly status as a servant in Sarai's home, and it reinforces the fact that her prospects in fleeing to Egypt are pretty dim. So by calling her name, and reinforcing the fact that she is a servant to someone else, Hagar is more intimately aware with her lowly position. The question here for Hagar in this instant is, what is going to happen to me if I make it back to Egypt, where I was only a servant, where the Pharaoh very easily gave me away to someone else? What kind of a life would I even return to, assuming that I can even get back to Egypt? So this is part of the instant recognition that is going to be Hagar's as this appearance comes out of nowhere and questions her with where are you going and where have you come from. Now the angel knows very well who she is and where she's come from, why she is fleeing and where she is trying to go. But he doesn't give her a lot of time to ponder the question. He doesn't engage in any kind of a dialogue with her. What he wants to do is reinforce the reality that she has no place to go. And here, God is going to intervene in her life in a very radical way. So verse 8 then, she responds to this and says, "I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." She doesn't attempt to hide who she is. She doesn't try to downplay the reality of her status. She tells the angel very honestly that she is fleeing. There aren't a lot of details given, but the angel very, very quickly gives to her the instruction that I am most certain she does not want to hear. So the instruction here is in verse 9. "The angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority.'" Literally, it says, "Return and submit under her hand." Now, you could almost see her shoulders slump as she thinks back to her life with Sarai and what the angel is telling her to do. The last thing she wants to do is to go back where she came from and to submit herself to this ruthless, oppressive rule that would come to her under the hand of Sarai. But this is exactly what the angel instructs her to do. Now, as we think about this, we think about the difficult circumstances that we can often find ourselves in. We can say, "I feel afflicted, I feel oppressed, I don't feel like this is right, this is not just, I didn't do anything to deserve this." And we can cry out for God to intervene. And God does intervene. He doesn't do it as quickly as we would like for Him to, but God does intervene, and sometimes God tells us to do the very thing that we just don't want to do, and it really is the response to go back and get some more of what you're trying to escape from. Think about this. Sarai is a slave. She's a servant. She's being very poorly treated. It's very harsh. And the angel says, "Aw, I feel really bad for you. Go back and submit." Is that what you want to hear? Is that what you want to do? No, it isn't. But that's the reality. What we lose oftentimes in God's response to our affliction, in the waiting of the resolution of that affliction, what we often lose sight of is God's purpose in this affliction, in this process that we're going through. We want a quick and an easy out. We want God to rescue us. We want God to reverse the circumstance. And in this case, and I believe in many cases, God says that's not the way it's going to work. Go back and submit yourself to the person or to the place where you're being mistreated, because I have a greater plan and a greater purpose than you can even begin to imagine. God doesn't always give us what we want. And that's really a good thing. It's far better than we think it is. God always has a time frame, but it's never as quick as we would prefer it to be. But God has a purpose. So on the heels of this lowly status being reinforced and the reality of the harshness of Hagar's life and the angel telling her to go back and submit, he very quickly moves into letter E, the promise that God is giving to Hagar. Verse 10, "Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, 'I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count.'" The promise is very simply numerous descendants. Now, does that sound familiar? The promise of innumerable offspring elevates Hagar's lowly position and also ensures her future position. As hard as life has been, and as uncertain as life is going to be by going back and submitting to the wicked Sarai, God has made a promise here that you are going to have descendants that are too numerous to count. She's a lowly servant, but in reality, she is much, much more than that. I believe that there is a relevant application for us here in our own lives, because I would venture to say that most of us feel like we're pretty lowly in the scheme of this world that we live in. We're not stately. We don't have positions of prestige. We aren't super wealthy. We don't have people knocking on our door asking for our wisdom and our insight. When we recognize who we are outside of Christ, who are we? We are wrath-filled enemies, worthy of death, worms, if you will. We're entitled to nothing, and yet we're really much, much more than that. Why? Because God loves us. Because God has a plan and a purpose for us that far exceeds anything that we can even imagine. Is that because of who we are? No, it's because of who God is. And it's because of what God desires to do so that He can be glorified. Now, I could go back and I could make a rabbit hole trip here and tell you about my life, tell you about my history, tell you about my upbringing. And I could promise you this. If you looked at me as a 15-year-old, you would have never guessed with a million tries that I would be a pastor today. You would never have guessed it. I was a heathen of heathens. I knew nothing about God. I knew nothing about the Bible. I didn't want to know anything about God. I lived the life of a hellion, and yet God miraculously saved me because He desired to do something more for me, for Himself through me, than I could ever imagine in my lowly state outside of Christ. We all share that in common. Hagar is no different. She is the low of low. She's a slave. She's a woman. She's in a very oppressive culture. She's being mistreated by the people who are responsible for her. The last thing she wants to do is to go back and get some more of that. But this is exactly what God wants her to do, because He has a plan for her that is greater than she can even begin to imagine. numerous descendants, more than you can even imagine. So in chapter 17, Abraham, when his name is changed, is praying about this still unborn heir who is going to be the recipient of the covenant promise that God made to Abram. And by the way, Ishmael is not the one of the promised covenant with Abram. He's outside of the covenant. And so as a part of God's response to the prayer that Abram is praying, he says this in Genesis 17:20, "As for Ishmael," Abram is praying about Ishmael, "I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes and I will make him a great nation." Now that has a lot of questions that are laced into this because of what we're going to learn about Ishmael. But the reality is this. God is telling Hagar to go back because I have a great plan for you. And God confirms that plan in a response to Abraham's prayer by telling him what is going to come out of Ishmael's life. Hagar was far more than just a lowly servant. She was the matriarch of a future nation that would be great. Now, it wouldn't be great in terms of the covenant promise that God has made, but it would be great in terms of its size and of its influence. So God made the promises of numerous descendants to Abram. He eventually makes the same promise to Isaac in chapter 26 and to Jacob in chapter 28. And here God makes this promise to Hagar. She is the first woman to receive promises from God. That is not incidental. That is not coincidental. It is a part of God's plan and the reality that Hagar plays a role that is far superior to the lowly status of a slave that she is and currently living out. Here we are, some 4,000 years later, still talking about Hagar. Who's going to be talking about you and me in 4,000 years? Probably nobody, unless something really unforeseen happens before our physical lives end. But here we are, still talking about Hagar, and this encounter with the angel of the Lord as it relates to the pregnancy and the son that she's going to give birth to. So, very quickly, moving from the promise, the angel goes into the prophecy. The prophecy is found in verses 11 and 12, and these simple verses will tell us the name, the character, and the legacy of the son that she is going to give birth to. Verse 11, "The angel of the Lord said to her further, 'Behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction.'" So the first thing that we learn is the name Ishmael, the name literally means God hears. God heard Hagar crying out as a result of the way Sarai was treating her. God heard her in her affliction. Now, it's very unlikely that Hagar is crying out for Yahweh in her affliction. She would likely have been crying out to one of the many Egyptian gods that she was familiar with. But the one true God heard, and he heard her because of her connection to Abram. When we cry out, God hears. You should probably underline that, circle it, highlight that in your Bible, because God hears when we cry out. Now, it's a little different from when we hear our own children cry out. We stop and drop everything we're doing and we run to them and we say, "What's wrong? How can I help you? Where do you hurt?" Right? Isn't that what we do? As much as we would like for God to do that, He just doesn't. Now, we have to remember that God is infinitely wise. God knows what He's doing. He doesn't need our help. He doesn't need parenting advice from us. God rarely responds as quickly as we would like Him to do, but that does not negate the fact that God hears us when we are oppressed and we cry out to Him. Always, God hears. So, Abram would be greatly blessed, and God will bless those who bless Abram. Hagar's conflict is not with Abram, it is with Sarai, and God was going to take care of Hagar because of His covenant with Abram and because of Hagar's connection to Abram. Now, Hagar certainly didn't understand all of this, and this would eventually be unfolded throughout Israel's history. But this prophecy that is given, that is being given here, should be very significant to us, because here is this Egyptian woman who is likely worshiping Egyptian gods, who is the second wife of the father of the covenant, and she's pregnant with this child and on the run, and God hears and makes this promise to her that this son Ishmael is going to be the father of a great nation. Second thing that we learn here is the character, and the character is unsavory. So verse 12a says, he will be a wild donkey of a man. So his character defies a single word description, a single word definition. And I chose this word because of the technical definition that you would find in a dictionary, which is, quote, disagreeable and unpleasant because he is morally disreputable, end quote. That's what unsavory means, and that is what Ishmael is going to be like, but far beyond that. You just can't define his character in a single word. So in the Old Testament, this phrase, donkey or wild donkey, is used to describe someone who lives their life as a true individual with no restrictions and no desire to conform to social convention. He is a wild individual, wildly individualistic, and does not want to be boxed in any way, shape, or form. It would be the epitome of a defiant child who will look at you at 2 and 3 and say, "Don't you tell me what to do." This is the character of Ishmael. Now, God would describe Israel during the height of their rebellion to the prophet Jeremiah using this phrase, and it would say, it says here, a wild donkey, this is Israel, a wild donkey accustomed to the wilderness that sniffs the wind in her passion in the time of her heat, who can turn her away. All who seek her will not become weary. In her month they will find her. It gives you a picture image of how morally destitute Israel was at the time that this was given to Jeremiah. This is the constant character of the son Ishmael, who would not be boxed in by anyone or anything. He's going to do what he wants to do, and no one's going to tell him, no, he can't do that. Ishmael would not be the kind of guy you would hope your daughter brings home to dinner. You would go, "What in the world are you thinking?" Now, what is so troubling for us is to realize that this son, who is going to be born under the protection of Abram, is going to be this kind of an individual who is going to live his life outside of the covenant that God made with Abram, and is going to have here this legacy of constant conflict. The latter part of verse 12 says, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. He will live to the east of all his brothers. So Ishmael is going to live in perpetual conflict with those around him, even with those in his own family. That will be the legacy that his descendants are going to follow. Why would God do that? Why would God provide this protection? Because God is faithful to the promise he made to Abram, that he would bless those who bless Abram, he would curse those who curse Abram. And God is not going to deviate from his character just because Abram has sinned. Now, we'll talk about that here in just a second. So throughout all of the Old Testament, the Ishmaelites will be a constant source of conflict for the future nation of Israel. They were known to be slave traders. They were in some way connected to the Midianites, but not all Midianites were Ishmaelites and vice versa, but that seems to be some kind of a shared ancestry that they had together there. What we do learn very quickly in the book of Genesis is that much, much later, Joseph is going to be sold into slavery, and it will be the Ishmaelites who buy him for 20 shekels of silver. Well, this hostility that is found within the Ishmaelites towards everyone does not go unchecked. So during the reign of David, they joined a coalition of nations who would join themselves together against God and against Israel. And we read from Psalm 83, "For they, this coalition of nations, have conspired together with one mind against you. They make a covenant, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagarites." And then it goes on to list many, many other nations who are part of this coalition. So the Ishmaelites are always going to have their fists raised to everybody, and everybody will have their fists raised against the Ishmaelites, and this will very significantly impact Israel's future as they have to contend with the Ishmaelites. Now, in modern times, Ishmael is considered the father of the Arab people, most all of whom consider Israel their enemy. Arabs have their fists raised to the nation of Israel, and Israel has their fists raised to the Arab people. Ishmael is recognized by Muslims as the ancestor of several northern prominent Arab tribes and the forefather of Adnan, who is believed to be the ancestor of Muhammad. Muslims also believe that Muhammad was the descendant of Ishmael, who would establish a great nation. So Ishmael's hostility towards God, man, and the people in general was not limited to just the Old Testament. It is still being experienced today. The enduring conflict in the Middle East is heavily influenced by the ancestral legacy of Ishmael, who will be in conflict with everyone, and everyone will be in conflict with him. Ishmael will continue in the line of Cain as a violent and wildly belligerent man. Cain killed his brother Abel through his descendants. We saw how that violence raised. Here, Ishmael is picking up that line of wild violence that will be lived out, not only through his life, but throughout his ancestry as well. You'll also note at the very tail end of this that Ishmael will live to the east of his brothers. And most times in the book of Genesis, when something goes to the east, it means they are going away from God. And this is exactly what Ishmael is doing. He is symbolically moving away from God, and he is physically and literally moving away from his family because of his nature of being wildly violent and in conflict with everyone. So we finish here in verse 13 with Hagar's response to this incredible promise and prophecy at the hand of the angel. "Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, 'You are a God who sees.' For she said, 'Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?'" So Hagar gives to God a name, El Roy, the God who sees, or the God who sees me. She is the only person in the Old Testament who confers a name upon God. She recognizes that God is omniscient. He sees everything. And she also marvels in knowing that God has seen her. And in her understanding, whether this is accurate or not, she has seen God, and yet she still lives. So this lowly servant who is oppressed and desperate and without hope has seen God in her own estimation, and God has seen her in her affliction, and he is moved to action. He has made this promise, he has given this prophecy, and what ought to be abundantly clear to us in this narrative is very simply this. God's grace is at work all the time in ways we can't imagine, and towards people that we would not think are worthy of his grace. Pause right there, and that's not our decision to make. God has plans beyond our understanding, beyond our finite minds, and yet God chose to extend grace to this individual Hagar, who is going to be the matriarch of a wildly angry and violent nation who would do nothing but wreak havoc against his people, basically forever. So God intervenes, this God of grace. He allows Hagar to understand who he is. She gives to him this name, that he is the God who sees, and she believes she has seen God. Whether this is a theophany or whether this is a messenger of the Lord, the promise and the prophecy are still very, very true. At the tail end of this, she gives a name to the well or to the spring that she is at. We read that here in verse 14. Therefore, the well was called Be'er Lahai-Roi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. And the name means the well of the living one who sees me. This is what Hagar has named this spring or this well. This is in the Negev, the wilderness between Canaan and Egypt. And this encounter ends very, very simply with this description in verse 15 and 16. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. So Abram is now in Canaan for about 11 years from the time of his call to leave Ur of the Chaldeans. He's been told the promise of the land and of an heir over and over and over. He has had this own experience of the smoking pot and the flaming porch making this unilateral, unconditional covenant between God and Abram. And here it is now in the 86th year, a short time after that his first child is born. Not a child of the covenant, a child outside of the covenant, but still a part of God's promised plan, or a part of God's plan, however. So Hagar obeys what the angel told her. She returned, she submitted, and she gives birth. We aren't told, but it's quite likely that Hagar recounted with Abram this encounter, and that is why the name Ishmael was given as instructed. So Ishmael would be blessed because Abram was his father, and Abram's descendants Israel would be in conflict because of Abram's sin. So the blessing that comes to Hagar is a result of the covenant God made with Abram, and the consequence of this sin is going to be experienced through the ongoing conflict between the descendants of Ishmael and the people of the covenant, the nation of Israel itself. There are so many different things that we could look at and focus on here. The thing that stands out to me is very simply this. Hagar was an individual that we would never expect, for one, to be the recipient of great promise, and the one to whom great prophecy would be given, but that's exactly what has happened. And this is all because of God's grace. Now, what is true for you and I today is we are not fully aware of the promise that God has made about us, to us, in light of our service to Him. And we have no idea what prophetic words are in the heart of God as it relates to the lives that we will live and the legacy that we're going to leave behind. Now, we have an impact on that legacy, don't we? What would have happened if Hagar said, I'm not going back, I'm not submitting, I'm going to do my own thing? We don't know, we can only speculate. What happens when we say to God, no, I'm not going to submit, I'm not going to obey? We don't know, but we can only speculate. I can promise you this, obeying and submitting to God brings great blessing to our lives. Rebelling and running from God is going to bring very difficult consequence to our lives. And we get to make that choice. God is a God of grace. What is it that He desires to do in our lives today? Would you pray with me, please?